time to get started. Let's review where we were up to. So we're talking about ontological models and specifically no-go theorems that we can prove against various types of properties that you might want these models to have. So last time we ended up talking about contextuality. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about contextuality, and then we will talk about psi-ontology down here. Probably won't get onto Bell's theorem, but we might. We'll see how it goes. All right, so, oh, what's that? Whatever it is, it should go away. Always something, right? I didn't know that I had that. Okay. All right, so if we remember, so we're talking about measurement contextuality and Cauchy Speckle contextuality in particular. So remember that so for measurement outcome pairs, we define an equivalence relation, which just means that if whatever preparation I do, the probability of getting outcome K when I measure M and the outcome L when I measure N is the same. That's the equivalence relation. There's no way of telling them apart by any preparation that you can feed into that measurement device. So if they are represented by the same POVM element, then we have this equivalence. And then the definition of measurement non-contextuality says that if these are equivalent operationally, they should be represented the same way in the ontological model. So if there's no observable distinction between the measurement outcome pairs, then we represent them by the same response function. Okay, so that's non-contextuality, and if we prove that that can't happen, then it's measurement contextual. Now, we can have a measurement non-contextual model, the Beltrametti-Bugacki model, which just basically reproduces the quantum probabilities directly, has the quantum state as the state of reality. That only depends on the POVM element, those probabilities, so it's measurement non-contextual. But if we demand that in addition to that, the model should be outcome deterministic, so for a projective measurement, we demand that every projector either occurs or doesn't occur, so every measurement outcome is assigned a definite, every measurement is assigned a definite outcome, then as we saw last time, you can't have that. Okay, so that's where we were up to. Now, in quantum foundations, we're kind of obsessed with inequalities. Whenever there's something weird that we test, we like to write down an inequality that you then go and do an experiment for. So people like to write down inequalities for non-contextuality, but it's kind of a bit tricky to think about what's going on. So if you remember the 18-ray proof, this is the 18-ray proof of the Cauchy-Speckle theorem. So the points represent pure quantum states, and they're grouped together if they form an orthonormal basis. Okay, so according to the Cauchy-Speckle definition, non-contextuality, in each of these grouped sets of vertices, one of the vectors should get value 1 and the rest 0. But the problem is that however you try to do this, when you start trying to fill them in, so I'm trying to say, okay, in this basis, I'm gonna choose this black one to have value 1, and then, okay, so these three have to have value 0, and then if I look in this one, these three have to have value 0, etc. Okay, so you try to start filling them in a consistent way. And however you do this, there's always one basis left over that you can't fill, right? So if we look at this basis here, I can't fill that basis because, okay, can it be this guy? No, it's orthogonal to that. Can it be this guy? No, it's orthogonal to that. Can it be this guy? No, because it's orthogonal to that. And can it be this guy? No, because it's orthogonal to that. So that basis, once I've filled in all of those vertices that I have, I can't fill in the last basis. So it looks like if you try to fill in with values, then at most we end up having 1, 2, 3, 4 values, vertices given the value 1, and then we can't go any further. Okay, so some people like say, oh, well, there's an inequality for you. In a non-contextual theory, this probability of getting outcome phi j given lambda can be at most 4. However, that's not correct, because what the 18-ray proof tells you is not that a non-contextual theory can only give you the value 4. It tells you there is no non-contextual theory, right? Any theory has to specify some probability of outcomes for these guys. So this is just simply not a prediction of anything at all, right? So there, instead of saying that this inequality holds, we have to say, no, it's just that no non-contextual model exists. So question is, can we make sense of this kind of inequality in any way as telling us something about non-contextuality? There are a few different ways of doing it, but let me tell you one way of doing it. So let's consider a situation where, so this set M is our set of measurements. So we have some finite set of orthonormal bases. It might be the ones in the 18-ray proof here. Okay, so let's suppose that phi is one of the basis vectors in M. Then I can define this set here to be this gamma phi M. This is the set of lambdas that always give me outcome phi with certainty when I measure in basis M, when I measure in basis M. Okay, so that is some set. Again, it might be the empty set, but we can define that set. Okay, so now I can define the set that's non-contextual for phi in the following way. I take the intersection over all measurements that contain phi. So phi, the basis vector phi might be in this basis and also in that basis. So I take the intersection over all these sets. Okay, so what is this? Well, this is the set of ontic states that is always going to give probability 1 to this outcome, regardless of the basis that it appears in. Again, this might be the empty set. There might be no such things. But we can say that's the set of states that are going to give you the outcome phi non-contextually. It's kind of a subset of your full ontic state space, that there's some subspace on which things are, this vector is represented non-contextually on that on this subset here. That makes sense? Okay. Right. So then, if we have a Cauchy-Speck non-contextual model, then in a Cauchy-Speck non-contextual model, all of these sets are the same. Right? Because if the model is non-contextual, then either it assigns probability 1 or probability 0. And the ones that assign probability 1, it doesn't depend on what basis you measure in. So in a non-contextual model, all of these sets are the same, and so they fail this intersection is the same as any one of those sets. Okay, so in a Cauchy-Speck non-contextual model, if I measure in this basis, I can always restrict this integration to this set, because in a Cauchy-Speck non-contextual model, I only ever have values 1 or 0. So I don't need to integrate over the ones that have value 0. That's going to be the same as the non-contextual set here. But this now has value 1 everywhere on this set, so it's just going to be this. So this is the probability that the model, so I'm going to call, this is just a definition of this probability, the probability assigned to that set. So it's easy to see that that follows from Cauchy-Speck non-contextuality. It's actually equivalent to Cauchy-Speck non-contextuality. I'm not going to go through the details of that, but there are, again, measure zero issues here, because I can always have, if I have sets of states that behave contextually, but they measure zero according to all of these probability measures, then they won't have any detectable effect. So you can always sort of get rid of them from your ontic state space without changing the predictions. So if we have a, however, if we have a Cauchy-Speck contextual model, then first of all, this set here can be larger than that set. And second of all, there could be some states which are non-deterministic, so which give you the outcome with probability between 0 and 1. So those two things can happen. And in that case, if we integrate just over this set, we won't get the full quantum probability. So in a Cauchy-Speckert contextual model, this will be less than or equal to that. But nonetheless, this quantity still makes sense, the probability assigned to the non-contextual, the set that's non-contextual for phi. So it measures the proportion of the probability for of obtaining this outcome that is accounted for by ontic states that are non-contextual for that state. Okay. All right, so now, if I have two states that are orthogonal, then they can appear in the same, let's say they appear in the same basis, then these non-contextual sets are disjoint. Why? Because in that case, there exists a basis that includes both of them. And then these two sets are disjoint, the ones that depend on M, because I have to have that this holds. So when if I were to sum over a complete orthonormal basis here, then I have to get some outcome, so the probability would be 1. If I sum over a subset of an orthonormal basis, that's less than or equal to 1. So when this is equal to 1, then that must be equal to 0 and vice versa. That means these two sets are disjoint. But by definition, right, this is the intersection of all such things like that. So by definition, gamma phi 1, the non-contextual set, is a subset of that. Gamma phi 2 is a subset of that. So if these two are disjoint, then these two also have to be disjoint. Okay, so now you learn that regardless of whether your model's contextual or non-contextual or whatever, if you take an orthonormal basis, then any lambda can be in at most one of these. The difference here is that it doesn't have to be in any of them because it could be a contextual state instead, for instance. Either a non-deterministic or a contextual state. Okay, so now we can make sense of this because the inequality tells us that the probability assigned to the non-contextual sector of the theory can be at most 4 for all lambda. So if I now integrate this over lambda with respect to some input state, then here all I'm doing is I'm averaging this over lambda. This holds for all lambda, so when I take the average, it's still going to be 4. So this tells us the probability assigned to the non-contextual sector of the theory is less than or equal to 4 in any ontological model. So we know there's no non-contextual ontological model here, but we can nonetheless have a contextual, a Cauchy-Speckert contextual ontological model, and this will apply to that model. And so therefore, if we find that the quantum probabilities are greater than 4, then you've detected that that you must have contextuality because a Cauchy-Speckert contextual model would assign all the probability to this sector. Okay, so even though there's no non-contextual model, you can still make sense of this inequality as saying this is the amount of probability that can be assigned to the non-contextual sector of the theory. Does that make sense? More or less? All right, so now we're going to look at a specific kind of contextuality inequality, which has turned out to be a very useful and powerful class. So relatively recently, a few years ago, Cabello and Severini and Winter introduced a way of constructing contextuality inequalities based on graph theory. So we consider a graph. A graph is just a set of vertices and the set of edges connecting pairs of vertices. So here's an example, just this pentagon graph here. Okay, so for this graph, to each vertex of the graph, we're going to assign some pure state in a Hilbert space. Okay, so each vertex gets a quantum state. And if the vertices are connected by an edge, then we demand that those states should be orthogonal. Okay, so the state assigned here should be orthogonal to the one assigned there, and it should be orthogonal to the one assigned there. Okay, so now we define the independence number of a graph is the size of the largest set of vertices such that no two vertices are connected by an edge. So this just means, if you think about it, what I have to do is color in color in as many vertices as I can, such that the neighbors of those ones aren't in the set. So if I color in this vertex here, then I can't have these two because they're connected by an edge. But then I can choose to color in either this one or that one, and then that's the largest set I can have. So the independence number of this graph, for example, is 2. Right, so what we showed in the previous proof is that if I have two orthogonal quantum states, then their non-contextual sets are disjoint. So a Cochin-Specker contextual model can only assign, if I assign value 1 to this guy and a value 1 to that guy, then I have to assign value 0 to the rest. So this tells you that the probability assigned to the non-contextual sector has to be less than the independence number of the graph in general for any input state that I choose to test. Okay, so now you also want to be able to determine the maximum possible quantum violation of that. So here are the quantum probabilities. So you want to maximize over two things. One is the set of states assigned to the vertices, because although I have to have the orthogonality relations here, I can change the Hilbert space dimension, I can rotate the states around and things like that. So you have to maximize over all states that satisfy those orthogonality relations. And then you also want to maximize over the input state that you're testing, this quantity. So that's what that is, subject to orthogonality constraints. But it turns out this quantity was already studied in graph theory for completely different reasons, and it has a name. It's called the Lovatz theta function. The important thing about that is that you can go and look in research papers where people have computed this for lots of classes of graph. But in particular, you can also efficiently compute it numerically. There's algorithms for doing that. So now we know that for these CSW contextuality proofs, you get a contextuality proof if you find a graph for which this Lovatz theta number is greater than the independence number. Okay, so this example was known before all of that stuff, but it's an example of this type of proof. So if we take this pentagon graph here, as we already said, the independence number is 2. So this is the inequality that you get. And the maximum quantum violation you can find in a three-dimensional real Hilbert space. So I have a unit vector. So these guys have to be unit vectors in 3D space. So they always can be written like this. I can choose my psi. The optimal psi is to just choose one which has a component 1 down here and 0 the rest. And then these angles are chosen this way. This will look very uninsightful, but I'll show you what this looks geometrically on the next slide. And then you find that you get that the quantum value here is root 5. That is actually the Lovatz theta number of that graph. It's larger than 2. Okay, so let's give some bit more insight into the structure of these states. So this Kliachko proof is sometimes called the pentagram proof, because I have a pentagram here. So we've had the Star of David proof yesterday. We've got the pentagram proof. I do have to apologize to any Christians in the audience. There is no cross proof of anything. So there is something called the cross polytope, which comes up sometimes in studies of non-locality. But anyway. All right, so we're in real three-dimensional Hilbert space. So the unit vectors lie on a three-dimensional sphere. Okay, and orthogonality is the usual orthogonality. So it's not the Bloch sphere, it's real three-dimensional Hilbert space. So let's imagine that we draw this pentagram on the equator of the Bloch sphere like this. And then you can see that the angle between this state and this state is larger than 90 degrees. That's no good. It doesn't respect the orthogonality relations. So what we're going to do, take these things on the equator and slide them up the Bloch sphere, right? So take this whole thing, take this whole pentagram and slide it up the surface of the Bloch sphere. As you do that, the angle between these vectors will decrease, and at some point, you'll hit a point at which all those angles are 90 degrees. So it kind of looks like this, right? So here's the center of the sphere, and I've moved this pentagram up so that this angle becomes smaller. Okay. So eventually the angles will hit 90 degrees, and then we'll have these orthogonality relations, and so that's how you get your quantum value. And then the state psi that you're using is just poking straight up along this axis, the z-axis. Right. So all of the inner products between psi and these four and these five states are all the same, which is what we had here. Okay, so that's how it works. And that's just an example of this type of proof. But in principle, you can do this kind of construction for any graph. You write down a graph. If you find its Lovatz theta number is larger than its independence number, then you have a proof of contextuality. Yeah.
So what is the difference between in the previous slide? So what's the difference of this graph, the star, with that one?
This one. Okay, so this I've drawn as a pentagon. It's the same graph, right? I've just moved the vertices around, right? So here, this is the abstract graph, and here I'm representing how I'm going to actually represent these states on the unit sphere in Hilbert space, okay? So it's the same graph. You can see 0 is connected to 1, which is connected to 2, which is connected to 3, which is connected to 4, which is the same as we had here. But I have to find a Hilbert space representation in which things that are connected by an edge are orthogonal. So I, for instance, I want 0 and 1 to be represented by orthogonal states. So I need the angle between 0 and 1 to be 90 degrees, right? So that's why so you actually don't want them to be close together on the unit sphere. You want them to be at 90 degrees to each other, which is why we reorder things like this, because those things connected by an edge, they're going to end up at 90 degrees to each other when I raise this up the unit sphere. So it's just a question of the distinction between the abstract graph and a particular quantum representation of the graph in terms of unit vectors.
So but if it's the same graph, you should get the inequality.
Yeah, it's the same inequality, right? It's the same graph. So a non-contextual model has to satisfy this. Uh-huh. The quantum predictions satisfy this, right? So that's a proof of contextuality.
Oh, okay, yeah. Right? The first inequality would mean that it's non-contextual.
This would be for a non-contextual theory, yeah. Yeah. Okay? Yeah. All right. So, now we're going to move on to the next topic. And part of the reason for going through that non-contextuality inequalities business is that it's useful for this. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to investigate whether pure quantum states have to be part of the ontology. For mixed quantum states, it's sort of obvious that at least partly they can represent classical ignorance, because one way of producing a mixed state is to flip coins and prepare different pure states. So we expect that mixed states at least are partially epistemic in some sense, or it can be represented that way. The question that we want to deal with is whether pure quantum states have to be part of the ontology, as it is in Beltrametti-Bugatski model, the Bell model, or de Broglie-Bohm theory, or if the kind of psi-epistemic explanations that we were talking about in the Speckenstoy theory could actually apply in quantum theory. Okay, so I'm going to use naughty notation here because, you could have preparation contextuality, but you only have preparation contextuality for mixed states. That's all that we proved. And you can always, what we will prove will not depend on which of the probability distributions for a given quantum state we're talking about. So it will apply to all of them. So I'm going to talk about probability of lambda given a state. So what do we do? So first of all, we need some definitions. So we can define the amount of I'm going to call it the amount of epistemic overlap between two quantum states in a given ontological model this way. So we just basically take, the diagram is probably easier to understand, we take the two probability distributions and we basically compute the area that's the joint area under both of those graphs. This is a measure of the degree to which those probability distributions overlap. So for every lambda, we choose the minimum of these two and integrate. Okay, so that's clearly a measure of overlap. But it has a nice operational interpretation, which I won't go through in detail. So suppose somebody either prepares this probability distribution or that probability distribution with 50-50 probability, doesn't tell you which. And then suppose you're the quantum measurement device and you see what lambda is, right? In our actual world, we don't have access to lambda. It's the ontic state, it might be hidden. But suppose you really knew what lambda is, and then you had to try and guess, was it this probability distribution that was prepared or that probability distribution that was prepared? Now, clearly, if you get to lambda that's somewhere here, you'll say, oh, it's this guy. If you get to lambda that's somewhere here, you'll say it's that guy. But if you get a lambda in this region, you can't tell with certainty, right? Maybe you will, for instance, if I'm over here, you probably should guess this guy because it has a slightly higher probability. But you won't get that right 100% of the time. And it turns out that the probability of successfully predicting, oh, that should say psi or phi, not psi or psi, psi or phi, which of these two was prepared, if you know lambda, is linearly related to this overlap measure. So it has a good operational interpretation. All right. So now we say that two states are ontologically distinct in an ontological model if they have zero overlap. So the cartoon is like this. The two probability distributions just don't overlap at all. So if you know lambda, you'd be able to tell with 100% probability. This is the case of ontological indistinctness. So you wouldn't be able to tell with 100% probability in this case. So you have to be a little bit careful with these definitions if you care about things, measure theoretic things, because, so here's a quick question for you. If I had this, so I suppose this is probability of lambda given psi, and it's a different color. And let's suppose that we have a delta function distribution here. That's probability lambda given phi. That's a delta function, okay? Are those ontologically distinct or ontologically indistinct? Who thinks they're ontologically distinct? One, two. Who thinks they're ontologically indistinct? Who doesn't know? Okay, so the question is, so I'm being careful, I'm saying, if you know lambda, then you could tell with probability one, which one was prepared. Now, if lambda is here, then basically phi says that will always be the lambda prepared, whereas for psi, this is a set of measure zero. So if you guess psi whenever you're here or here, and if you guess phi when you're exactly at that point, you'll still win with 100% probability, right? Because the probability that you'll get exactly that lambda when psi is prepared is actually zero. So well, sometimes when we're thinking about this informally, we talk about do the probability distributions overlap or not. Obviously these overlap, but the sort of correct thing to really say is this is the condition. Because you might want to say, well, shouldn't I think of this as psi epistemic? There's overlap. But remember, the psi epistemic explanation of the indistinguishability of quantum states means that there should be some probability, there should be some non-zero probability of being in the overlap region. Because if you're not, if you can't be in the overlap region, if the probability of being in the overlap region is zero, that doesn't help you explain the indistinguishability of quantum states. Okay, so moving on. So we call an ontological model psiontic if every pair of pure states is ontologically distinct. So you can have things like this, of course, but the cartoon version is like this. There's no overlaps between anything. And otherwise, we call it psi epistemic. Now, I want you to note here that this is a very, very weak definition of psi epistemic, because it would be psi epistemic if I only had two states that overlap, and that overlap could be arbitrarily small. Okay, so a model like that isn't going to help us with the kinds of explanations we have in the Speckenstoy theory. So we will ultimately want to look at stronger definitions of what it means to be psi epistemic. But if you can try and prove this directly, if you end up proving that models have to be psiontic, then you don't care about, you know, you've ruled out something very weak. Great, you know, okay. All right, so let's have a look at what we know. So the first thing we know is that psi epistemic models do indeed exist in all finite Hilbert space dimensions. We actually don't know that for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces yet, and I have a suspicion that it's not true, but that's still a subject of research. So for the Cochin-Specker model, for instance, if I have two non-orthogonal states, I have this sort of cosine theta distribution here. There's a significant region of overlap between those two. But actually, you can prove that psi epistemic models exist for any Hilbert space dimension. For d greater than 2, here are two papers where it's done. There is an issue with these models, though, which is that suppose I take two non-orthogonal quantum states, and I consider what the amount of classical overlap, the amount of epistemic overlap, is as I increase the Hilbert space dimension, right? So as you increase the Hilbert space dimension, the amount of epistemic overlap between the probability distributions for a fixed inner product, goes down in these models, right? Goes down towards zero in the limit of infinite dimensions. So although those are formally psi epistemic models, it's going to get harder to explain the indistinguishability of quantum states in terms of that overlap, because it gets smaller and smaller. So what should we do next? So given that psi epistemic models exist, we can try and do two things. One is we can try and prove something weaker than psi ontology. We can come up with a stronger definition of what it means to be psi epistemic, and come up with theorems just without any additional assumptions in the ontological models framework. And that's what we're going to look at for most of the rest of today. Or we can add some additional assumptions, right? So the ontological models framework itself is kind of very, very general. And there might be assumptions that we would like our models to also satisfy. In this case, having to do with how subsystems compose in the theory. So if you do that, you can get full psi ontology theorems that show that you have to have a psiontic model. And actually, you're going to be they haven't done this tutorial yet. No. Monday. On Monday, you'll be working through basically the proof of this theorem in tutorial. So I'll say a little bit about it, but not too much. All right, so I'm going to go the other way and say, okay, what can we prove just without making any additional assumptions? So let's consider what is supposed to be the explanation of the indistinguishability of quantum states in a psi epistemic model. The explanation is that psi and phi cannot be perfectly distinguished because sometimes the ontic state is exactly the same, regardless of whether psi or phi was prepared. So sometimes you're in this region, and in that case, you won't succeed, even if your measurement device has access to the full ontic state. So if we choose a suitable measure of the probability of the overlap of the probability distributions and a suitable measure of the indistinguishability of the quantum states, if it's the case that these probability distributions have a very, very tiny overlap, but their indistinguishability is large, then this explanation is not really playing much of a role. Okay, so this is the kind of thing that we would like to be able to prove. Okay, so what we need to do is we need to compare measures of the overlap of the quantum states measures of the overlap of the probability distributions that have the same kind of operational meaning, so that we're comparing like with like. So we already introduced this epistemic overlap, which had the following interpretation. If you prepare the system in state psi or phi with 50-50 probability and you don't know which, then if you know the exact ontic state, the optimal probability of guessing correctly is this, okay? And there's a comparable quantum overlap measure, which is this thing. Okay, so for those of you who've done, some of you have probably done quantum information classes, this is 1 minus the trace distance, if you know what that is, for pure states, and it has a comparable operational interpretation. So if your system is prepared either in the state psi or phi with 50-50 probability, and you want to guess which is which based on the outcome of a quantum measurement. So now you don't get to see lambda, but you have to do some quantum measurement, a POVM, the optimal POVM for guessing, then the optimal probability of guessing correctly is this. It's the same where we've replaced this classical overlap with this quantum overlap. So those are comparable, those are measures with a comparable interpretation to compare. Okay, so then we say a model is maximally psi epistemic if for every pair of pure states, these two measures of overlap are equal. And what that says is that the indistinguishability of non-orthogonal states is entirely accounted for by the overlap, the indistinguishability of the epistemic states. And you can check, for the Cochin-Spaecker model, if you enjoyed doing the integral to check that the probabilities are reproduced in the Cochin-Spaecker model, then this is a problem of similar difficulty to prove that the Cochin-Spaecker model is actually maximally psi epistemic. It's pretty obvious for the Spaeckens toy model. So for the Spaeckens toy model, if you have an x state and a y state, I don't know why I'm doing a different color here, but I am. So if I have that state versus this state, then if I know lambda, for either of these states with 50% probability, I'm going to be in the overlap region. And in the overlap region, you can do no better than guessing 50-50. So the probability of successfully guessing is going to be, I guess it's 3/4, right? Because if I'm here, then I do 50-50 guess. But if I'm here or here, I get it right with certainty. But actually, in the Spaeckens toy theory, I can do, let's see, yeah. In the Spaeckens toy theory, I could do either an x measurement or a y measurement. So if I do, say, this measurement, it's actually just as good at distinguishing the states, because if I get the plus outcome and I guess this guy, and if I get the minus outcome and I guess that guy, that also has probability of success 3/4. Right, because let's see. So with 50% probability, with probability a half, I've prepared this guy. With probability a half, I've prepared that guy. Okay, so when am I going to be correct? So I'm definitely going to be correct with probability a half times a half. So if I prepare this guy, and I'm in that state. Okay, but if I'm in this state, then I only get it right with probability a half. So it's half times a half times a half. So I'm in here, I'm in this state, and then I guess it right with 50% probability. And then here, with probability a half, I'm in this state, and I guess right if I'm down here. I'm hoping that evaluates to 3/4. Let's see. So I got 1/4, plus, well, if it doesn't, I've done something wrong. Doesn't look like it's right. I've done something wrong here. Anyway, I don't want to spend a lot of time worrying about that, because it's going to get us off track. But if you think about it, if you think about it, that model is maximally psi-epistemic. Anyway, so however, we can rule out this for dimensions three or larger using non-contextuality inequalities. So remember, if we're talking about Cauchy-Speicher contextuality, we have to have a Hilbert space of dimension three or larger, and non-contextuality inequalities will give us bounds on the amount of overlap. Let's just see how that works. Okay, so the first thing to note is that this epistemic overlap is less than this thing. Okay, so what's this? This set here is the set of ontic states that have non-zero probability when you prepare phi. Okay, so the point is that if I can replace this minimum everywhere by just this guy, because that's larger than it, and that giving me a less than or equal to sign, but this quantity here is zero. So when this is zero, the minimum is always this guy, so it's zero. So if I restrict attention to the set on which this is non-zero, right, and then just replace the integral with just this, it can only get larger. Okay. Now, did we already show this? Yes, we did. We showed this when we were talking about Hardy's theorem. So this was the lemma that we proved the other day. This set is contained in the set, in this set. So this is the set that gives me the outcome phi whenever I, with certainty. The set of ontic states that give me the outcome phi when I do the measurement m with certainty. So support of phi is included in that. And if you remember from last time, we derived that from, the derivation of that was based on the fact that this probability has to be one. Right, so we proved that as a lemma last time, that this implies that's a subset. Okay, now, however, this is going to be true for any basis that includes phi. Okay, so what that means is actually this is going to be a subset of the non-contextual set for phi. Right, so you know, technically, if you like measure theoretic derivations, this set, let's see. Yeah, okay, well, let's forget about the measure theory. This set is inside all of these sets. So if I take the intersection of all of those sets, it's still inside the intersection, at least providing we're only talking about a finite number of bases, which we are. Okay. Okay, so that means that in this integral, I could replace this set with that set, and this can only get larger. But this is precisely the non-contextual probability. Okay, so the epistemic overlap is bounded by the non-contextual probability that psi assigns to non-contextual set for phi. Okay, so if we consider a set of states, then, and we sum all of these epistemic overlaps, then that has to be less than or equal to this, which is precisely the thing that's bounded by a non-contextuality inequality. So what can you do? Well, you can then compute the quantum overlap for the optimal states in the contextuality inequality. Now, note there's a slight difference here. The quantum overlap, if we go back, is this thing, whereas in a non-contextuality inequality, you would be computing just this part here. So it's slightly different. I've got to do 1 minus the square root of 1 minus that. Okay. So that makes a slight difference. It means that, so what we want for ruling out maximally psi epistemic models is we want to find that the quantum overlap, that this quantum overlap is larger. But just because the probabilities are larger doesn't necessarily mean that this is larger. And in fact, if you use the Kliachko inequality, you don't get anything out of it, unfortunately. But anyway, if we use other contextuality proofs, then we sometimes find this is larger. Okay, so what I'm actually going to do is compare the averages. So I take the average of this and the average of that. This means that both of these quantities are between 1 and 0. And So what we want is that, so if we find that this is large, this is close to one, while this is small, then the psi epistemic explanation is in trouble, because it means that sort of almost every state in this set has large overlap, whilst almost every whilst their classical overlaps, almost all the classical overlaps are really small. Okay, so what we would like is to find situations where this is close to one and this is close to zero. So again, this is a topic of active research, so I can tell you what we know. So here are some results in the literature which are based on different contextuality proofs. Some of them are CSW contextuality proofs, this one is a CSW contextuality proof, and so is this one. These are different types of contextuality proofs, but they're still contextuality proofs. And here's the dimension of the Hilbert space, here's that these proofs exist in, here's the number of states, here is the epistemic overlap for those constructions, and here's the quantum overlap. So that all looks complicated, but what you can do is let's take the difference, because remember, we want this to be close to a one and this to be close to zero. So if I take the difference between this and this and just optimize that function over D and the number of states, then you can find out what's the best numerically we can do, right? So these are the results that we have so far, and the best we can do is to show that the difference between the quantum overlap and the classical overlap is somewhere about 0.3. And this proof is not a very nice proof in some ways, because it's not constructive. It just shows that there exists a graph for which there's a CSW inequality for which this holds. Actually, not easy to construct that graph, and it requires the limit as the number of states and the dimension of the Hilbert space goes to infinity. So that's the best we can do. The best we can do in, let's say, the best we can do with some reasonable dimension and reasonable number of states that you might actually be able to do in an experiment is this one. So nobody has done an experiment on this yet. They have done an experiment on that and got much values much worse than this. So experimental tests of these non-maximally psi epistemic theories are kind of in early stages, and the results aren't that good, I would suggest. So what we would like is to find a proof in which this is close to one and that's close to zero. And it's unclear whether we can do that right now. I suspect we can, but that's there's no concrete evidence for that. So that's where things stand with ruling out. So we can rule out maximally psi epistemic theories, but we can't make it so that, okay, yeah, I should say something else here. If you're thinking about the indistinguishability of two non-orthogonal quantum states in an ontological model, there's two mechanisms that can account for that, right? So it can be accounted for partly by the overlap of the probability distributions, but it can also be accounted for by the fact that your response functions don't tell you everything about lambda, right? They only give you coarse-grained information about lambda, and this is obviously precisely why, in, say, the Beltrametti-Bugatsky model, non-orthogonal states are indistinguishable, despite the fact that if you knew the ontic state, you would be able to distinguish them perfectly. It's because the response functions don't tell you everything about lambda. Okay, so we have two mechanisms. And the question that you sort of have to ask yourself is, if I'm a psi epistemicist, should I say that all of the explanation has to be in terms of overlap of probability distributions, or should I allow some of it to be due to the coarse-grained nature of response functions? Now, if you remember in the Speckenstoy theory, the knowledge balance principle there implied that you couldn't know lambda exactly. It implied that there had to be some coarse grading. So there's no real good principled reason for saying that all of the indistinguishability has to be in terms of overlap, right? So that's why what I'm driving at here is to try and find a situation in which the overlap is really, really tiny, classical overlap is really, really tiny, whereas the quantum overlap is large. Because if you find something like that, then you have a really good case that the psi epistemic nature is playing basically almost no role. Whereas if you've got a number like 0.3, what does that mean? It means that some of the indistinguishability is explained by overlap, and some of it is explained by coarse graining of the response functions. How much should be explained by overlap in a psi epistemic model? There's no real principled reason for saying one thing or another right now. Okay, but the hope is to push these results into a better place where these numbers get closer to one. Okay. Oh, now I've just said all of the things that are on this slide. I'm ahead of myself. So is non-maximally psi epistemicity significant? So then we have these two ways of explaining things. It's not clear why this second explanation shouldn't play some role. Therefore, my goal in this kind of research is to try and get that as close to what? See, I knew what I was going to say before I was going to say it. There we go. All right, so now let's look at, I'm going to briefly look at the assumptions behind the PBR theorem. You're actually going to prove it in the tutorial, so I won't spend long on it. So actually, this theorem here was the thing that sort of kicked off all the work on studying no-go theorems for psi epistemic models. So this theorem actually proves that ontological models have to be psiontic, but it makes an additional assumption in order to do so, right? Without any additional assumptions, we have psi epistemic models. This additional assumption is called the preparation independence postulate, or at least that's what I call it, and it breaks down into two assumptions. So the first assumption is called the Cartesian product assumption. So suppose we have two systems which are prepared in a product state, psi A and psi B. Importantly, when they're prepared in a product state. Then it says the ontic state space for the joint system is lambda A Cartesian product with lambda B. What does that mean? It means that each system has its own ontic state, lambda A and lambda B, separate states. And the ontic state of the joint system is just consists of specify the ontic state for A and specify the ontic state for B. And the second part is the no correlation assumption. It says that when I prepare a system in a product state, I actually just get independent distributions for those two. So those are the assumptions. Some of these assumptions have been criticized. In particular, this one has come in for the most criticism. So let's think about it. So first of all, it's important here that this is a product state. Because if we prepared an entangled state, what we're trying to do is have a theorem that has as its conclusion you must have a psiontic model, right? If I have an entangled state, then that's neither a property of system A or system B. It's a joint property of the joint system. So it must be the case that when I prepare entangled states, I can sometimes have a violation of this kind of assumption, right? So in general, a joint system with two subsystems could have global ontic properties that don't reduce to the properties of individual subsystems. So that would definitely be the case in a psiontic model with entangled states. It's not a property of either subsystem. So in general, you need to think, in order to have this assumption, you need to think, okay, my joint ontic state space consists of some properties of system A, some properties of system B, plus some joint properties that are neither properties, that are just properties of the joint system that don't reduce to either one. And for entangled states, the quantum state would live in here, right? So all we really require from the Cartesian product assumption for the proof is that this part plays no role when you prepare a product state. So when the system happens to be prepared in the product state, then all of the support of the probability distribution lives in this part. And this doesn't play any role. Right. So then the no correlation assumption needs to be read as applying just to the marginal distributions on this set. So you need to set things up that way, because if you're going to have a theorem which implies that you have that the quantum state has to be real, then you better include the case that the quantum state is real in your framework. So you can argue, so the argument is whether this is natural. Is it natural to you know, if we're going to have this structure in general for entangled states, is it natural to say that when I have a product state, this plays no role? It seems, I mean, it's natural in the sense that, so actually, I've been having a lot of arguments about this with Rob Speckens recently. And so his argument is like this: look, any argument for this Cartesian product assumption is an argument for getting rid of this in general, right? So you might say, okay, I have two subsystems. It's very natural that they have their own set of properties, right? But why is it natural that they have, if it's natural that they have their own set of properties when you prepare a product state, why is it not also natural when you prepare an entangled state? Also still a natural assumption then as well. So it's controversial. That's one of the reasons why we like to try and get rid of these assumptions. Okay, so the theorem, however, says that if you have an ontological model that satisfies the preparation independence postulate, it must be psiontic. You're going to go over the proof of this in the tutorial, so I'm not going to belabor it. But here's the strategy. First of all, you prove it for the case where the mod squared inner product is a half. And then, so when the states are more indistinguishable than they are here, you can prove it by reduction to that. And then when they're large, let's say less indistinguishable, you reduce it to there. And the methods for doing that are outlined in the tutorial, so I'm not going to belabor it anymore here. Let's see how we're doing for time. 3 more minutes, okay. So the PBR theorem is going to render psi epistemic explanations implausible within the ontological models framework, at least if you buy the additional assumptions. The upshot of the overlap bounds right now is more ambiguous. There is, you know, I wrote a long review article about this in 2014. Apart from sort of fundamental interest in this question, it turns out that many of the other no-go theorems can be implied by having a psi ontology theorem. So if you think about, for example, Hardy's excess baggage theorem, if you can prove that the quantum state is real, then the cardinality of the ontic state space is obviously at least as large as the cardinality of the set of quantum states. So you have nothing left to prove, right? But I can prove Hardy's excess baggage theorem without any additional assumptions in the ontological models framework. I can't prove PBR without it. But if I had a psi ontology theorem which didn't require those extra assumptions, which say maybe holds for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, if I had better overlap bounds, then I might be able to get all of those theorems from just one result. Okay, so here are some things that are possible. It's possible that we can obtain better overlap bounds, better than 0.3. Maybe we can get larger values in dimension 4 that you could do an experiment on, for instance. It's still possible that psi epistemic models are impossible for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, because we have no psi epistemic model for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. All the models we have are psiontic. And also, all of the results I've been talking about have been just for projective measurements. So it's possible that you can't have a psi epistemic model if you allow POVMs. And one piece of evidence for that is that if you take the Cochen-Specker model is for projective measurements, and you say, okay, let me keep the ontology the same, let me keep the representations of the states the same, and try and find response functions that can reproduce POVMs in general, you can't do it, right? So you can actually prove that if I choose the POVM, which is sometimes called the trine POVM, which consists of POVM elements that are proportional to the projectors on these three states, then you can't reproduce the statistics of that in the Cochen-Specker model. So that's far from saying that you can't do it in any psi epistemic model, but there's some evidence that there'll be some additional constraints there. All right, so since that's the conclusion of a section, that is a natural place to stop today. Does anybody have any questions, comments before we finish?
So it can still happen that in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces you have psi epistemic?
It's an open question, right? So all of the psi epistemic models that we've constructed so far if you increase the overlaps tend to zero as you increase the Hilbert space dimension, right? So if there's a psi epistemic model for infinite dimensional Hilbert space, we don't know it yet. Or it could just be that there is a no-go theorem. I suspect there's a no-go theorem because, since the publication of the PBR theorem, there have been a number of other results, again, based on additional assumptions, right? But those assumptions are a little bit weaker. So the assumptions are getting weaker than in the PBR theorem. And those theorems have as their conclusion psi ontology for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So since those assumptions are getting weaker and weaker, I do wonder whether we can reduce them to no additional assumptions. So I suspect that's the case, but I can't prove it right now.
Are these results made psi epistemic explanations like much less popular in the community?
Well, how popular were they to begin with? Okay, so in the interpretations of quantum mechanics, most people are either realists or believe in some sort of Copenhagenish stuff. Most of the realists already advocate psiontic theories, de Broglie-Bohm or Everett or something like that. So the number of people who are both realists and psi epistemicists was probably quite small to begin with, but it has more to do with the fact that people didn't notice the possibility and tried to rule it out than the fact that it's not a good thing. So I think these results make it awkward to be, so if you're a realist, and you want to be a psi epistemicist, you should be a non-ontological models type of person, right? So more exotic ontology. But most of the people who are realist psi epistemicists, such as Rob Speckens in this building, for instance, already wanted to go outside the ontological models framework because it's non-local, because of Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem says it has to be non-local. Non-locality is a very unnatural thing, especially if you're a psi epistemicist. And, Einstein's arguments look compelling to you, then you'll want to try and look for a more exotic ontology in which you can have locality anyway. So it doesn't really shift those people's positions because it's that they already wanted to be outside the ontological models framework. But nonetheless, I mean, one of the things I maintain is that in debates on the foundations of quantum mechanics, we should try to prove theorems and do experiments rather than just sort of debating the merits of things just with words, right? So this is kind of like a starting point. One of the reasons for discussing the ontological models framework is it is, in a sense, the most natural framework for realist theories. So if you learn that you can't have certain property in it, it does tell you something about what you're going to have to change in the actual theory. So I think these, regardless of whether there are actually living people whose view is ruled out by these theorems, I think they're nonetheless quite interesting. And anyway, in the last lecture of this course, I will prove at least one theorem which rules out positions that people actually currently believe. So there is at least one result like that. anyway. Okay.
So when people reject the ontological model, the thing they don't like about it is that it's local, did you say?
Well, I mean, the main reason people might reject it is because we're going to talk about Bell's theorem next time.
Yeah.
Bell's theorem is going to imply that ontological models have to be non-local.
Yes.
So there are two responses to that. One is to say, oh, ontological models are so natural that I'll just bite the bullet and say everything's non-local, non-contextual. And that's what you do if you believe in de Broglie-Bohm or spontaneous collapse theories or whatever. Or you could say, that's so horrible that I need to go outside this framework. So Everett would be an example of that because it rejects the single world realism that we have. But but Copenhagenish type interpretations would also be another example of rejecting that. Okay, I will see you Monday.